Hi, this is Dr. Bud Pearson. Welcome to another Oregon Crossroads, where we talk about important issues of the day. And today we have a great guest before us. We have Mr. Steve Dole, and Steve is someone who I've heard a lot about, who has been very, very important in justice and crime. And Steve is a president currently of Oregon Criminal
Crime Victims United.
Oregon Crime Victims United. And this is an organization that looks at criminal events from the victim's point of view. And it's not, you know, we have a lot of press going on right now about criminal justice reform, pretty much aimed at the offenders on the criminal justice side. And Steve stands for the victims. And I want to open it this way so you understand Steve's background. Because I did some reading, about Steve. And when I think about our society, it was formed with our initial document, which was our Declaration of Independence. And the whole purpose, if you look around that document, is our inalienable rights of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And those are considered, from the religious point of view, God-given, and from the non-religious point of view, nature-given. Rights that we have as individuals that cannot be taken away from us by any entity. So that's the right to be alive, to be free, and to pursue our lives the way we want. And so Steve's daughter, who was 12 years old at the time, was walking, it sounds like, home from school, or walking, I don't know the details. And some person, 16-year-old, decided to kill her with his car. Random, sounds like struck her with the car and she passed away. So that is something that no parent ever wants to experience. I think it turned out that the person who did that spent 28 months in the system of criminal justice system. And again, if you want to have a, first thing, I'm a dad, and there's nothing that I could imagine like that happening to me and what my reaction would be. And so we'll let that go. But again, what a failure of our society and culture to allow or to try not to prevent this kind of act from occurring. Because if you want to have a society that people value living in, they have to have the sense that they're safe, their life won't be taken from them, and that they are again free to act and they don't have to protect themselves. Because if your whole life you think about, am someone going to shoot me or hurt me or kill me or run over me, that's a society that you don't want to live in, and you can't prosper, you can't advance. So again, I just want to apologize, first of all, to Steve, for the fact that we didn't do more as a society to do something about that. Now, let me just say that, so the mostly what I want to do with this interview is to hear about what he's learned about this, because obviously Steve is very interested in, number one, prevention of anything like what happened to his daughter. And then obviously, if you have people that have committed crimes, what is his view on what is appropriate punishments? That's legitimate. And then number three, I know he's done a lot of work on this, is how can you rehabilitate people potentially so they come out and they're not a threat again? Because when you've crossed that line, there's something about, if you think about human nature, there's murder and rage in every one of us, but very few people act out on that. And what do you do with people that have crossed that line and that has happened and committed serious crime? Now, we're not talking about some other things. It's interesting to me when we talk about criminal justice reform, we usually talk about people, isn't it awful that people are in for drug offenses, they didn't hurt anybody and they shouldn't be in there? Well, yeah, okay. A lot of us will go there. That's the presentation. But behind the presentation, things are moving on these serious crimes that are never presented to the public, but they're there, and they change dramatically how society punishes and actually deals with people that have crossed that line and have taken a life or harmed someone greatly. So that's what we're going to do. We're here to learn from Steve. I've said enough because this is limited, but I've been thinking about this, and to get a man like this who's experienced that level of tragedy, and then he's spent decades now working through that, but also how do I turn something good out of it? And it can't be good, but something positive out of it. Let's hear from him. So again, thank you. Appreciate you coming out.
Thank you, Bud.
And so what triggered this really also was a couple of pieces of legislation. One was legislation that really narrows the number of crimes that are that the death sentence can be applied to for the very few people on death row. And even more disturbingly, when cases go back for appeal, which they all do, now the new rules apply, which means the death sentence is basically going to be washed. That's the first thing. And the second is criminal justice reform laws passed, especially, I think, on the juvenile side.
Yep.
Well, enough of me. Go ahead. I want to listen to you.
Well, you've done your homework.
Okay.
I appreciate that.
Sure.
I think that one of the things I've learned is that we struggle with a lot of myths that we're told about crime and the criminal justice system. And, you know, before I was involved in all this, I mean, my experience with the criminal justice system was going to court for a traffic ticket. And my experience in politics was, you know, going to the polling to vote,
sure.
Which we used to do. Don't do that anymore. But the point is, you know, I this is the last thing I ever thought I'd be involved in, obviously. And one of the things that I learned is this: is that I think that many people, and I can't speak for everybody, when you hear people talk and they think that people snap and do these things. So, not to personalize this, but I want to tell you about what happened with this 16-year-old who killed my daughter Lisa. And by the way, he happened to kill her with an automobile, but he was not on drugs. He was not on alcohol. And in fact, he didn't use either one. And there was a lot of background and investigation that went on this. And he was not having a psychotic break. And just as a backgrounder, he had about 160 IQ, which I'm sure yours is probably up there
not
close to that, but I'm nowhere near that. I think that's what they call near Mensa, if I'm correct on that. I think demonstrates, and it's one of the things I've learned about failed policies that our lawmakers make and the administrative state, if you will, carries out in their interpretation of how we do things in this country, and this is a good example of it in as it applies to criminal justice. This was a young man who, starting in the seventh grade, took a pipe bomb to school, and from there he escalated to killing small animals specifically, and there's a name for this, and I can't think of what it is, but specifically setting cats on fire, which has a psychological diagnosis, and also taking small animals and pulling their appendages off while alive. So from there, he set some fires, and then once he got his driver's license, he would get young girls in the car with him, and he would just exhibit strange and dangerous behaviors. This is all documented in the investigations. There were reports. This was a stranger-to-stranger incident. He did not know Lisa. Lisa did not know him. We didn't know this family, despite the fact that both families lived in Lake Oswego. There was some evidence that he stalked her the day before he murdered her, and I won't go through all that. But he did, in fact, run her over on North Shore Road. For people who may be familiar with Lake Oswego and North Shore Road, I think most people know that that's a road that is a 20-mile-an-hour speed limit. And when he hit her, he was doing in excess of 45 miles an hour. Now, if you can imagine going down that road at 45 miles an hour, I can't. I've lived there for 40 plus years. There are no sidewalks on that road. However, we always taught our children to walk in the berm of the road and as close down towards the houses as you could. And there were actually tracks from his car down through the lawns and the flower beds, if you will, that demonstrated that exactly what his intent was. But that's just a little bit of background. But the point I'm trying to make here is this. At that time, and unfortunately we're going back to this, at that time had the juvenile justice system done what they should have done with this kid and put him into McLaren for a short period of time to receive treatment and to receive, you know, and I'm not talking about a long sentence here, I'm talking about anywhere from 6 months to a year. This may not have happened. And but instead of that, they have this thing about, you know, the left does not like to incarcerate people, even though back in those days McLaren was not really an incarcerative setting. It doesn't have a fence around it back in those days as it does now. But so instead of doing that, they left him in the community and they kept treating him in the community despite the fact that he was escalating his behavior. The one thing that I failed to tell you, and this is how bad it finally got, and I do have to say this, that 2 weeks to the day before he murdered Lisa, the police got a call from what they called his peer counselors at school. He went to LaSalle High School. And his peer counselors, who were a set of twins, whose names escaped me, but they were on the phone with him, and it was a weekday night. He was talking about to be or not to be. Then he was talking about going out and killing women. And so they didn't know if he was going to commit suicide or if he was going to go hurt somebody. They got their mother listening in on this, and she went, you know, this is before cell phones, or you know, she went next door, called the principal to the school or the vice principal. They got a hold of the police department in Lake Oswego. They went out to the home. They knocked on the door. The father came to the door. They said, we have a report that we're concerned about your son. Is there anybody else in the house? He says, my wife, she's in bed. This is now 10 o'clock at night. And they said, we want to see your son. They went upstairs and they knocked on his door and they asked for him to come out. And they heard nothing, so they went to enter the room. There was something up against the door. And they told him if he didn't come out, he was going to break down the door. So they heard whatever the object was move, and he came flying out the door. Now, this was a home that had like a foyer and stairs going up both sides of it with the bedrooms on the top. He came up running out the room with a blunt object in his hand right at his father, and had the police not been there, he would have taken him over the railing down to the floor below. The police handcuffed him to his bed. They took him off to St. Vincent's psych ward. This happened 2 weeks to the day before Lisa was murdered. And right then and there, something should have been done. But one more time, complete system breakdown and failure.
And no one responsible, no individual, and everyone. The one thing I would say, just wondering, what happened? So after he spent his time, 2.5 years, 28 months, have you followed his course? Do you know if he's not so much, just wondering if it'd be interesting, the incarceration part changed things. See what,
well,
I'm saying? That isn't enough at that point, but I'm just saying the treatment part.
Here's what little I do know. Okay. When he was in college, he had a couple run-ins with the law. Okay. I don't think they were too serious. I think one involved a misdemeanor assault. What I do know about the guy is he became a professional hacker.
Wow.
And he is a hired gun, an independent contractor, and he works for large companies. There's some stories I do know about him because I haven't tracked him, but because of my involvement with law enforcement and prosecutors, some of my friends have kept an eye out on him. And there's a couple of stories. We just don't have time to go into.
Okay. So let's focus a little bit on the current legislation. So the first thing is the death penalty redo. There's clearly a group in Oregon who don't want the death penalty.
Right.
And there's a strong legislative component or leadership to that group.
Right.
There's clearly polling that shows that the death penalty is likely to stay in effect if it's taken to the citizens' vote.
Absolutely.
And so therefore you have to do a backroom deal to get around that.
Right.
And so that's my understanding, is that it looks like, even though our leaders in the legislature and our governor say that they didn't know how this happened, that they want to go forward with legislation that will limit the kind of cases that are the death penalty applicable to pretty much none, pretty much none. But then it turns out that, of course, it is applicable on appeal when you really look at it the way they wrote it. And they say, we'd like to fix that, but of course, they really can't. Again, it's all the charade of politics.
Right.
You and I know that. It's a charade. So let's just talk about this, though, because they're moving in that direction. It's interesting, the death penalty isn't really carried out in Oregon,
right,
effectively. But when they did the new rewrite, they did still say that if you kill a police officer, that you're liable for the death penalty. So there are those that clearly feel that the ability to have a death penalty is a deterrent. That's the only reason to have that, so people won't do it. You know, it doesn't help you if they've killed you, but it can help you if they maybe won't because of the law. What's your sense of that in your reading and studies, the value of having a death penalty? Because society has to decide that. Is that something, do you think, from a prevention point of view, because we're talking about prevention, if it was actually carried out, do you think it would help us be safer?
Well, interestingly enough, and I wish I had it with me, there is, once again, this myth that, mm-hmm, well, the death penalty doesn't have any effect.
Mm-hmm.
Yet if you look at the states that have the death penalty and that actually use the death penalty, they have fairly low murder rates. The other thing is that, more specifically, because we all, for better or worse, depend so much on studies and academics to determine where we're going and, you know, policy and life, Emory University did a study a number of years ago that actually showed that the death penalty, despite what the anti-death penalty people say, that the death penalty is a deterrent. I just want to interject this. I don't come by my support of the death penalty easily. I was born and raised Catholic. And of course, the American Catholic Church teaches that the death penalty is wrong, or at least they started teaching it somewhere around the time that I think I was in college or so. Actually, if you look back to the catechism that I learned, there is a provision for the death penalty. But given all that, they have, in Oregon, for all intents and purposes, repealed the death penalty.
Right.
They've left four crimes. One of those crimes is that if you kill two or more persons, and they can prove, the prosecution would have to prove that it was involved an act of terrorism, that you were actively involved with terrorism and or terrorists. Well, here's the thing, we can rule that one out right away, because if you have a case like that, it's gonna go to the federal government. That's gonna end up in federal courts. Number two, you have the issue of the police. I think we have to have that. Number three, you have the issue of killing a child. And number four, you have somebody who is in prison that kills someone in prison, but they already have to have been in prison for and convicted of an aggravated murder, which raises the bar. Not a manslaughter, not a crim neg homicide, not a murder, but an aggravated murder. Here's the other wrench, though, that they threw into this. In most states in the United States, and in Oregon since 1971, and you know, I get a little, I'm not a lawyer, so, but we've used the words that when it comes to murder, that the operative word is that you have to prove and show intent on the part of the murderer. It does not include the word premeditation. Premeditation is a high bar, hard to, I mean, you know, how do you know at what time somebody premeditates? If I kill you right now, did I premeditate this for the last 6 months, or did I decide on the drive down? So that in and of itself is going to make it very difficult to ever reach and get a death sentence in the state of Oregon. But that sums that up. So what we've done is let's take the major things that we've taken out. We've taken out basically mass murders. If we had an incident in Oregon right now, think about Las Vegas, where somebody took a stash of rifles up in the top of the Marriott Hotel in Portland, Oregon, and during a summer festival opened fire on the festival below and killed 30, 40, 50 people and wounded 100. You got no death penalty to address that. If you have a serial murder, think about, I think most of your viewers would remember Dayton Leroy Rogers. This is a guy who abducted women, tortured them, In many cases, cut off their feet because he had a foot fetish, some of them when they were still alive, and then murdered them. These are what we refer to as serial murders. Ted Bundy, he did take a stroll through Oregon. We've had some in Oregon, noted serial murder. Those are off the books. Those cannot receive the death penalty anymore. If somebody murders a witness in a criminal case, they keep them from testifying, or murders a juror, those are no longer part of the death penalty. There's a number of crimes, because remember, death penalty crimes, what we call aggravated murder, these are not, we have a murder statute. That is that I walk in here this morning and I shoot you, and you know, that's that. It's all the same result there. It's a horrible thing. Now, if I come in here, I abduct you, I take you out in the woods somewhere, I torture you, and then I kill you, that's aggravated murder. So I think it's important for your viewers to know the difference. So basically what they've done, though, is they've stripped that all out to those four crimes. Like I say, there are really three, and that's the end of it. But there's more to this, because they've also put in this retroactivity issue. And that means that the pending cases that we had, and we've already had some high profile ones in the news. There was just one in Washington County, a man who killed a 15-year-old back in the 90s. He took her and put drugs into her and did horrible things to her, killed her, and then took her body down to the coast and threw it off the Astoria Bridge. That one came back. He was on death row. They retried him. They couldn't give him the death penalty because that no longer applied as a death penalty case. So you have that. Then you have pending cases. The most significant one that, or not, maybe they're all significant, but the one that people would know about is the Max Train murder up in Portland, who basically committed hate crimes and killed two people, wounded one, and you know, this guy was up for the death penalty. It's off the table now. So here's what's horrible about this: the legislature passed this. And the leaders on this told their colleagues, Republican and Democrats, time after time after time, there's no retroactivity in this. Don't worry about it. That's off the table. The pending cases, the people who are on death row that come back in appeals, they're still going to be subject to the death penalty. And then the legislature finishes, and we're waiting for the governor to sign the bill, and all of a sudden the AG's office comes out and says, This thing's retroactive. So the governor signs the bill, and of course the victims community, the law enforcement community, the prosecution community is up in arms, and we say, let's do a special session, let's fix this thing. Pretty simple fix, by the way. And we had all kinds of people playing games. Floyd Prezansky, who's no friend to crime victims, I have to put him up for it. He at least stepped forward and said, yeah, this thing needs to be fixed. The governor made some kind of a weak statement that said, yeah, I've looked at this. There's a lot of impact here on a lot of people, victims. We need to do something about it. Jennifer Williamson said at one point, no, I don't want a special session. Then she turned on a dime and says, yes, I want a special session, we should do that. Then she turned again on a third time. It's all documented. The third time she says, you know, this is exactly what I intended. This is exactly what we wanted. We don't want to do anything. So there was no special session. But they had until the 29th of September, when the bill went into effect, to do something about it, fix it. They didn't. So now all of these cases, all these pending cases, all of these people who are on death row, and there are 30 of them, and I would encourage your viewers to go on to Oregon Live in the February edition. Just click on Oregon's death row and read what these people have done. These are not, excuse me for, I don't know any other word to use, these are not ordinary murders. These are people who have done horrible, horrible things to human beings before they killed them. And so the bottom line here is that we had a chance to do the right thing, and we did.
I always look at it that what happens and what are people's rhetoric? And there's all kinds of ways to use rhetoric to protect yourself or to embellish yourself, and what is the result? So I look at Senator Brzezinski and Senator Williamson and Governor Brown, and I would say, and certainly had to bring in the Speaker of the House, Tina Kotek, and President of the Senate, Peter Courtney, and that's their bill. And the result of that bill is they've gotten rid of the death penalty, even though they won't take it to a vote of the citizens. And if the citizens vote to not have a death penalty, that's how it is. But not the political insiders who decide that we're not going to have the death penalty. That's absolutely wrong. So you know the five, in my mind, who are responsible. It's the President of the Senate, the Speaker of the House, Senators Brzezinski, Williamson, and Governor Brown. And if you're unhappy, it's called a ballot box. You need to take it there.
So can I say just one other thing about this?
Yeah, sure.
Crime Victims United actually did a poll on this of the legislators, because we wanted to know after the fact exactly where everybody stood, who was who and what was what. What we found out is we had support in the Senate to overturn or to take the retroactivity out. There were 17 senators. I think if we would have got a special session, quite frankly, I think I'm fairly good. I'm not as good as a lot of the pros in the building, but I'm pretty good at counting votes. I think we would have driven it to 19 or 20. On the House side, we found out that we had 26 votes. Well, we all know how transactional politics have become in Oregon. They've always been transactional, but they've really become transactional with Tina Kotek and Governor Brown.
Yes.
And nobody could look me in the eye. If we had Governor Brown sitting here today, I would love to have her look me in the eye and tell me that she couldn't get five votes if she wanted them. So for her to say we didn't have the votes, that is rubbish.
They got votes on PERS in the House, and that was so unpopular that people are paying it. So we know that. So that's politics. I would argue that this is probably the intent, and that whatever the explanation of the public is, how hard it is, we couldn't go there. We didn't mean it. Frankly, those are excuses, and the result of the action is how we should judge people.
Right.
Okay. And now, unfortunately, we are at our 20-minute limit. And what I would say is that we haven't been able to nearly cover what we wanted to cover, so we may have to do this again.
It's a huge topic. It really is.
And we try to do healthcare the last segment.
Right.
You can imagine that, healthcare reform and system. So what I would say is it's so important for you to do the work that you do. There's in all of us as Americans in our culture this soft spot for people that do wrong. And we want them, number one, not to do wrong, and number two, somehow we want them to be rehabilitated and to make things whole again. There's a couple things. One is there's a justice part in how we deal with that when people suffer loss, and how do you can't make them whole, but how do you recognize their loss? And number two, what do you do with individuals that, again, have crossed that line, and how can you have some sense that you can be safe going forward? And that's a challenge. And if all we hear is the soft side, justice, righteous justice can have a hard side, a consequence. And I would say that many times in the criminal justice system, it is a hard side. And as our society evolves toward this soft side and our feelings, we have to be safe. We need people like you to remind people what can happen when people do evil acts and how they destroy families and lives. And I so appreciate you and applaud you and for the work you do. And I wish you never got exposed. And I wish you were a citizen who just didn't know anything about this, went to occasionally a traffic ticket and voted. But thank you very much for what you do.
Well, thank you for having me. And I just, if I could say this, Crime Victims United has been involved in criminal justice reform. We're not about locking them up and throwing away the key.
Correct.
We do believe that people do violent crimes need to be held accountable and responsible for their actions, and there's got to be just deserts. But we've been involved in the criminal justice reform, but what we found out is the left wants to push criminal justice reform beyond drug offenses, beyond property offenses.
Correct.
And they want to reduce sentences for violent crimes.
Correct. And they don't tell us that. I agree with that. Amen to that. All right. Thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you.
Take care. All right.
I appreciate it. on the issue of criminal justice reform.
Right.
Back in 2013, they in 2011 and 2012, they had the Pew Foundation come into the state of Oregon, and they held meetings all over the place, and they came up with all these, you know, all these recommendations, including reducing sentences for some Measure 11 crimes that were violent crimes, including assault, robbery, and sex abuse in the first degree. That's the layman's term for that is child molestation, because that's what most of those crimes are. And by the way, when I say assault, this is not a bar fight where you break my nose, because that's at best a first degree misdemeanor, maybe not even that, maybe second degree misdemeanor. These are serious crimes that leave people permanently damaged, sometimes damaged for life, and sometimes without a limb, without eyesight, without hearing, less an organ, et cetera, et cetera. This is just one of those stories that you have to tell. I guess you could call it a war story, but the bottom line is they wanted to, you know, get more beds in the prison system, and yet they were literally ready to bring sex abuse in the first degree, child molestation, down to a point in the sentencing grid where the presumptive sentence would be probation, as opposed to what it is under Measure 11, which is 6 years and 3 months. So I went to a hearing and I said, you know, we all know that we're gonna have a legalization of marijuana in this state. And right now you've got about 200 offenders in the system, a little shy of 200 offenders that are questionable because they're not necessarily people who have dealt or manufactured, they're people who are users, possessed. And I said, let them go. Let them go, let them out of prison. You could have heard a pin drop in that room because people couldn't believe that Steve Dole was saying, let all these people out of prison. Of course, would they do that? No, because they're hypocrites. They're hypocrites. The thing that's bothersome to me about this whole topic when you talk about reducing sentences for violent criminals in particular, or for that matter, for property offenders, and I'm talking about incorrigible property offenders. I'm talking about the property offenders that we have that have done 3, 4, 5 felony property offenses, and at some point you got to cut them off. You got to give them a time out of a couple of years. Is that once we're experiencing historic lows in crime rates in this country. The average person wouldn't know it to turn on the 10 o'clock news on some stations because it just looks like all hell is breaking loose. But the reality is we came from Oregon before Measure 11 was passed. We had one of the highest top 10 violent crime rates in the country. And we came down and we were at about 57% from that rate we used to be after the violent crime rate went up 400% from 1965 to 1985 and then leveled off, kind of went up and down between 85 and 95. We had terrible things going on. If you remember in Oregon, Portland was a war zone in the 80s with the gangs and one thing and another. So now we have this historic rate, but believe me, you get rid of the death penalty, you lower these violent crime sentences, which is the next thing they want to do, is lower Measure 11 sentences or get rid of them altogether for adults. And once you do that, that crime rate's going to go the other way. It's just inevitable. And I don't think it's going to take as long as it did before. I think it's going to turn around sooner than we think. And of course, the people who are going to pay for it are crime victims and law-abiding citizens who unfortunately become crime victims. But here's the worst part of it, is where are the people going to be? And I'm talking about the people over in that building at the Capitol. Where are they going to be when all this starts happening? Do you think any of them are going to stand up and say, yeah, I was involved in the votes for that? And they're not going to do that.
They don't do that.
They're not going to do that.
No.
They will blame it on everything and everybody under the sun except themselves. So that's...
Okay. Very good. Great. Thank you.